Welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast. My name's Phil Topham, Executive Director of the FIEC. We're going to do our dive into the news, which is a thing we do every couple of weeks. And with me, as usual, is Adrian Reynolds, our Head of National Ministries. Good morning. Hello. Yep. And also John Stevens, our National Director. Good morning, John. Now, brothers, you are fresh from a trip to Poland, which we're going to talk about in a minute. It's been a difficult week news-wise, though. There's lots of horrible things going on in the world. Another school shooting in the States and gun policy very much in the top of people's minds across the pond. The war in Ukraine is still ongoing. We've got a couple of church things happening, Southern Baptist Church, and something to do with a clergy disciplinary measure, which we'll come on to. But let's start, if we can, in Ukraine, because I think that does fit with what you guys have been doing in Poland. You've been at the European Leadership Forum, and lots of folk from Ukraine would traditionally be there. Just give us an idea of where we think things are at in Ukraine, and also how churches have been responding to that based on what you've seen.
Why don't you do part one? I'll do part two.
Oh, yeah, well, it was great to be back together for the first time in 3 years with the European Leadership Forum. And it was very sad that our Ukrainian brothers weren't able to be there because of what's happening in the country. Mm. Also, there obviously weren't Russians who were there. Because we were in Poland and there were lots of Eastern European Christians who were there, I think it was just wonderful to hear how brothers and sisters have welcomed Ukrainian refugees in Poland, in Czechoslovakia, in Hungary. God has been doing some remarkable things in terms of bringing together Christians across divides to show love and care towards their brothers and sisters from Ukraine, welcoming refugees into their homes and caring for them, opening up their churches as hostels for them to stay in, and sending things to Ukraine to be able to help people. We were delighted to be joined by one of the leaders of the Ukrainian Evangelical Church called Yaroslav, who shared with us what was happening in Ukraine. And again, some absolutely remarkable stories of Ukrainian Christians and churches, how pastors have been driving into conflict zones to rescue people and take things to people. We see the stories of the horror of the war. Just a number of those who've been involved and near to the front line were speaking about actually the way God has used the war to bring the Christians together and actually to bring remarkable revival and spiritual growth. Mm. They've seen remarkable opportunities to be sharing the gospel with refugees, sharing the gospel with people, and very much their prayer was that this Ukrainian conflict and the refugee crisis that it has prompted might actually lead to the spread of the gospel. Mm. So they were thinking about Acts and the persecution of Stephen and how the fact that the church had to scatter because of persecution in fact led to a flourishing of the gospel. Yeah. And it was remarkable to hear brothers and sisters who are in that situation speaking in those terms about what they think God is doing through this. At the same time, a desire to want to be praying for and supporting and maintaining gospel unity with Russian brothers and sisters in Christ. Mm. Because actually the Baptist church, particularly in Russia, and evangelicals in Russia are persecuted in Russia.
Yeah.
And we need to be mindful of that. I was really encouraged. I'm a trustee of the European Missionary Fellowship, and it was great that there were some representatives of the mission there. And people in the UK have been hugely generous to their appeal to give to Ukraine. So I think something like £850,000 has been given, way more than anybody expected. Mm. And actually the mission has been passing that money to Yaroslav, and he's been using it to buy things in Poland to then be transported to the Ukraine. So it was just wonderful to make that connection and sort of meet the people on the ground who were taking that generous giving and using it to be a blessing to brothers and sisters in Ukraine.
It's so encouraging, isn't it, to hear how churches are stepping up.
Indeed. And by the way, you said Czechoslovakia. You meant, of course, the Czech Republic and Slovakia, two separate countries.
Thank you.
I think we're somewhat insulated just from the scale of what's going on. Mm. And I found that talking, especially to Polish pastors. I don't know if you found this, but I was talking to one Polish pastor called Adrian. I mainly go to the European Leadership Forum because lots of people are called Adrian.
So it's not very popular name in this country.
There's a solidarity
around Europe.
Anyway, Pastor Adrian Gdansk, Church of 150, of whom about 80 are Ukrainian refugees and have come in. So the church has doubled in size with Ukrainian refugees.
How's he handled that? That's huge.
Well, interestingly, his comment was that the church are basically doing all the housing, all the feeding. It's a corporate thing, not an individual thing. Mm. So largely here, I mean, we're slightly sort of virtuous about it, aren't we, when we have a Ukrainian family. And obviously, if you're a family and you're hosting a family, it's a really big thing. But if you're a church like we are of say, you know, 80 adults on a Sunday morning, having one Ukrainian family come to you or a couple, it's not significant. Double your church size suddenly is a really different dynamic. And what Adrian was explaining to me, which I hadn't really appreciated, was that there's a deep historical mistrust in Poland, actually of many other nations, Germany, Britain, because of what happened at Yalta, especially, and Russia, but actually Ukraine as well, because of what happened in the Second World War, very, very deep memories. And he said, what is fundamental in their church is they've had to get over essentially national hatred of Ukraine in order to be able to welcome people. So he said, what's extraordinary here is there is this amazing outpouring of grace and love and kindness towards Ukrainians in the context of people who were once enemies, essentially, and thought of that way. So he says it's an extraordinary demonstration of the gospel, more just than showing kindness to a neighbor. This is more of the Ephesians 2 stuff. This is more of an Ephesians 3. This is the manifold wisdom of God being displayed in the church as people who would once be enemies are brought together and are caring for one another and in one in Christ. So it's deeply significant, actually, what's going on, I think, in some parts of Eastern Europe. And we're just insulated from that. We don't really see it.
It's incredible.
And there were some of the challenges that our brothers and sisters are facing I hadn't been aware of. I was giving a kind of workshop on the gospel and politics. And again, the question was raised there afterwards by a Ukrainian. What about those evangelical Christians in Ukraine who are being kind of, in a sense, compelled to fight, but don't want to, don't believe that that's the right thing to do, and are facing the challenge of whether they should kind of, in a sense, obey government or not in that situation. And I hadn't really realized or appreciated that that was actually a situation on the ground for them. So there's some very specific questions that they're having to wrestle with as a result of those circumstances.
We pray on for our brothers and sisters in Ukraine and, of course, in Russia too.
And we'll do a separate episode on the ELF because it's a great initiative. It's great to be involved. Maybe 20 people in FIC churches and leading FIC churches there. So it's a good thing for us to tap into. We'll do a separate episode on it.
Thanks, Adrian. Well, we're going to move on now to a very sobering and different story that's come from the United States this week about the Southern Baptist Convention. And for those who haven't come across it and seen it, this is revealed years of cover-up of sexual abuse by pastors, youth workers, leaders against women and children. Russell Moore called it an apocalypse. He said it uncovered more evil than I ever imagined. It was harrowing and heartbreaking reading. How do we respond to that here, John, Adrian?
We respond as we always respond to these things.
We lament.
I mean, it is just extraordinary to read. Even the summaries really are almost unreadable. To be honest, and especially if you haven't been in that world and haven't been part of those debates and arguments, so it kind of hasn't been trailed. I mean, if for Russell Moore, who's been part and parcel of that, for him it's it's really, really significant. Yeah. But if it's the first time you're coming to it, it just sort of hits you like a brick wall. And our first concern, of course, is always for people who have been mistreated and abused and silenced and victimized, and it's just heartbreaking to see Christians doing that. You know, in a sense, when you see it in the world, it's very saddening, but not surprising. When you see it in Christians, it's just, it's heartbreaking.
An institutional cover-up, it seems, on a massive scale, which was always kind of denied, but this has revealed it and laid it bare.
I mean, I think what's really sad is, of course, that's not the first time that this has been the case. And at one level, that doesn't totally shock us. I mean, we've seen within our own context kind of churches and organizations that have covered up abuse. We've seen that within the Catholic Church with priests who've been abusers, who've been moved into other churches. Evangelicals have rather arrogantly assumed it wasn't them. We've seen the sort of appalling case of John Smythe and the abuse that he perpetrated, which to some measure was apparently covered up. And that's the subject of a very big report that's being undertaken by the Church of England at the moment. So this isn't unique or new. I think within the Southern Baptists, there was a group that wanted to bring about a conservative renewal in this group. And some of those who've been implicated have been at the forefront of that conservative renewal. So it really casts discredit on the gospel and a kind of a conservative Christianity. I think there's a sort of a cynicism in what's been revealed that is just deeply disturbing, that at an organizational level, it seems that lawyers have been more concerned about protecting the denomination, protecting its reputation, avoiding liability. What we're talking about is basically 700 people who've been accused of sexual abuse or sexual harassment. And the organization claimed that because they were autonomous churches, it had no role and it didn't keep a list. I think what's so shocking is actually they did keep a list. And actually, so at one level, that seems to be a kind of a straightforward lie about the nature of what they were doing. So they knew that these people were abusers or potential abusers, and yet some of them went on to minister in other contexts. And allegations of harassment against even their own kind of former kind of president who was leading the organization. So it seems a kind of a significant cover-up of abuse, not taking abuse seriously, not listening to victims, but more than that, an active kind of suppression of what they knew. But it is dealing with sort of sexual abuse and sexual harassment kind of claims. Obviously, it comes close to us within FIEC because we're also a group of independent churches. We're nowhere near as denominational as the Southern Baptists would be. They own seminaries. They have a common mission fund. They work together with a greater degree of kind of closeness, which is something that we don't do. But that responsibility for if you know within your network of churches there are abusers, making sure that those people can't simply move from one place to another and that's covered up. And we would say that the responsibility for safeguarding is the responsibility of the individual church. And I'm not aware of any instances where we're aware of cases of abuse or alleged abuse that is given to us centrally that isn't and hasn't been dealt with at a local church level. So, but we want to make sure that we're not falling into that same danger of a kind of an institutional defensiveness where claims like that are made.
And when we've heard about cases of sexual abuse in churches have removed pastors from their ministry, as far as the ones I've known about.
Well, the ones that we've been aware of, where there have been those cases, they've gone to trial, they've gone to the police, pastors have been removed, their accreditation has been removed. And actually, we're in a much smaller context and a much smaller evangelical constituency. They tend to be quite high profile and reported within the Christian media and by networks.
Another way this has played out is by saying because the Southern Baptist Convention is complementarian in its understanding of the scriptures, that is, it believes that the office of pastor elder is only open to suitably qualified and gifted men, that is part of the problem. That obviously comes very close to home for FIC. We are a complementarian group of churches. How should we wisely respond to that accusation?
I think that's a really important question. We did a podcast on that, Adrian and I, talking about that more at length. So we've discussed that sort of elsewhere. I'd recommend listening to that. And of course, complementarian covers a wide spectrum of different ways of relating, and any doctrinal position can be misused to be abusive. I think we have to recognize that it's wrong to conclude that complementarianism is automatically more likely to lead to abuse of women or cover-up of women. A number of the significant sort of public scandals that have involved sort of a sexual abuse and the cover-up of sexual abuse have actually been in egalitarian contexts. So one thinks of Bill Hybels at Willow Creek. That's an egalitarian church, but he was abusing members of staff and that was covered up internally. One thinks of the situation at Hillsong, where Brian Houston has had to step down, both because of allegations of drunkenness, but also an inappropriate time that he spent with a woman. And actually, there have been a couple of examples of other Hillsong pastors who've had to step down for that. So I think to draw the conclusion that it's complementarianism which is the cause of abuse, actually organizations which are egalitarian have equally seen abuse perpetrated and have covered abuse and not investigated it as a possibly. So I think we need to all in our groups, whatever our position is on the relationships between kind of men and women, be aware of the dangers of potential abuse. And I think it's not just complementarianism. Actually, it's about the abuse of power of leadership. So that can be men in ministry and women in ministry. And interestingly, there have been a number of claims of essentially pastoral malpractice, what you might call spiritual abuse, made against women leaders in churches, even in a British context. So again, it's the power of the position that often enables people to act in an inappropriate and abusive way. not just their particular theological position in relation to men and women and ministry.
I think, Phil, the question that leaders in FIEC churches need to be asking themselves is a slightly more constructive one. So it's easy to dismiss things like this and say, well, I'm not an abuser. I haven't done things like that. I don't misuse power. And of course, not only are we blind to our own sins, but I think I'd reframe it in a slightly more constructive way, which is to say, what are you doing in your church to nurture and develop a healthy leadership culture? So that's a slightly broader question. And I think it doesn't presuppose that everybody is already sinning and abusing their positions, because people aren't. And lots of our churches are healthy and going in the right direction. But I think constructively, we can ask ourselves as leadership teams and as churches, what steps are we taking to make sure that our leadership culture is healthy? And that will be driven by context and size and the kinds of people that you have in leadership and relationships. There's all kinds of dynamics going on. But I think that's a question that leaders should be wrestling with all the time, rather than just saying, how do I avoid this sin? How do I avoid that sin? I think part of Christian sanctification is avoiding sin, but it's also developing righteousness. So I think if you apply the same principles to church life, we need to be asking ourselves, how do I guard against sin? You know, so if you struggle with porn, you know, you put a porn filter on your computer, but you're also asking what deliberate steps do I take to be holy in this area of life? And I think it's the same for leaders. And we've got to be careful that as we get caught up in all these horrific scandals, which just seem to come week after week after week, don't they? They sort of seem to, it's like being bombed in the Second World War. It just keeps coming and coming and coming. I think we've got to make sure that we do step back as leaders and say, well, what are we doing in our church to develop a healthy culture? And in fact, we've got some seminars on that coming up at the Leaders Conference, because we think we need to just get back on the front foot. Because actually, if we're going to fight these things in the longer term and not just be firefighting, we've got to start at ground zero and help leaders, I think, build these healthy cultures.
And Ray Evans has written some helpful stuff on how we develop that kind of good leadership culture as well, which we can put some links into the bottom of the podcast. Another kind of church-related story that's been in the news this week relates to Reverend Stephen Sizer, a Church of England vicar. He is subject of a clergy disciplinary measure, I think, in a hearing this week. I believe that's happening in public, and that's the first time that's happened as a CDM. John, what are the kind of details of that? What do we need to know about?
Well, this is a five-day public hearing. Stephen Sizer has chosen to have a public hearing. A complaint has been brought against him by the kind of Board of Deputies of British Jews. I should say, I've never met Stephen Sizer, never been at anything he's ever spoken at or known, so I don't know him.
And what's the claim they've made about him?
The claim they've made him is he's anti-Semitic. And this has been...
Which he denies, right?
He denies that very strongly.
Yes,
ongoing kind of debate about his ministry that goes back many years. He's for a long time been a strong advocate of Palestinian rights. He's renowned for being anti-Zionist. That's been characterized by some as being anti-Semitic. At various points, he's linked to websites, comments online that have been regarded as anti-Semitic, and he's linked to them, and complaints have been made about him. And he has denied that he's personally anti-Semitic. In a couple of instances, he's taken those posts down and has apologized for them. So this issue first emerged in 2013, when again the Board of Deputies of British Jews made the same complaint against him. At that point, the kind of Anglican Church instituted a disciplinary process, which then went to mediation. There was a mediation process that was led actually by Sir Gavin Lightman, who was a Jewish High Court judge, and also I think the Dean of Christchurch at that time, which led to a resolution and the ending of that process, and a recognition that certain posts that he had made were offensive to the Jewish community, and he agreed to regulate his usage on social media. The issue blew up again in 2015 when he posted another kind of a link to a site that was offensive to the Jewish community. He took it down after 2 days. That led to another investigation by the then Bishop of Guildford, an evangelical bishop, who reached the conclusion at that point that Sizer, although the material he'd linked to was clearly anti-Semitic, that Sizer himself was not anti-Semitic. So the decision was made that his social media kind of would be controlled. He wouldn't be allowed to post in certain ways. At a subsequent point, he then posted again and he was banned from preaching, and then he's retired from ministry. So the Board of Deputies of British Jews has again raised that sort of issue and claim that he's anti-Semitic. And that's what's being investigated by the clergy disciplinary sort of measure. It's a 5-day hearing. Both sides are represented by kind of lawyers who are arguing on their behalf. Sort of Sizer claims that he is not anti-Semitic, he's just anti-Zionist. And some of the debates are about what is the meaning of anti-Semitism. So what does it mean to be anti-Semitic? And when does criticism of Israel cross over into a sort of anti-Semitism? So it'll probably be some time before the sort of results of that hearing are kind of public and made known, and whatever appropriate action is taken is taken.
Can I ask a broader question? Do we have a problem in conservative evangelicalism with anti-Semitism?
Well, it's certainly the case that the church has historically had a long problem of anti-Semitism, and I think we need to recognise that. And anti-Semitism is utterly wrong, a kind of a hatred of Jews.
It's racist.
Because they are Jews. It is simply a form of racism. And we have to look back at our whole history. I mean, the church has been historically anti-Semitic. Martin Luther said some absolutely appalling things about the Jewish community, which led and fed into actually anti-Semitism in kind of Europe. The Jews were evicted from England. It was Oliver Cromwell who eventually allowed the Jewish population to come back to England. So there has been a real history of genuine anti-Semitism on the part of the church. And we need to absolutely take that seriously. I think in contemporary society, there has been a significant growth in anti-Semitism. And anti-Semitism has been found both on the right in relation to white supremacists, also on the left, where again, it's become very much bound up with issues connected with Palestine and the politics of the Middle East. Now, how widespread that is within the church, in the UK, the Church of England recently apologised for past anti-Semitism and wants to make sure that it's not anti-Semitic. So there's always the potential that that is the case, but I'm not aware of a range of kind of claims being made of specific anti-Semitism on the part, certainly, of British evangelicals.
Racism in all its forms is wrong, and we need to make sure that we're guarding our hearts against anything like that as God's people, don't we? So Reverend Sizer, he denies being anti-Semitic, and we await to see what the outcome will be of that clergy disciplinary measure.
I think one of the challenges with dealing with this kind of situation is that those of us watching in don't have all the information and all that's happening there as an inquiry kind of moves forwards. So that the press published reports of the first day of the kind of hearing, but there haven't been reports of what's happened afterwards. So we're slightly in the dark of that. Well, it's just important that we recognise that we don't necessarily know everything as we kind of, in a sense, watch from a distance.
Thanks, John. Can we talk about marriage for a minute?
Let's.
A different topic. Adrian, you've picked up a story this week that we're at the lowest level statistically of marriages since records began. Just outline
that
for
us. So I have
here
the news article in front of me, which, by the way, has a little video of cute dogs and cats in the corner.
Is that linked to marriage? I mean, is your marriage more successful?
Why the algorithm feels that I don't really like pets, so why the algorithm feels I need that little corner. Anyway, there were 18.6 marriages per 1,000 unmarried men. And 17.2 per 1,000 unmarried women. I've never quite worked out how. Anyway, the lowest since records began in 1862. So
in basic terms, does that mean 19 men out of every 1,000 are married? Are getting married? No, 17 out of every 1,000 women are
unmarried
getting married.
Men. Yeah. Okay. A year. And it's the lowest it's been for a long, long time. That's true. Actually, interesting. That decline is true in same-sex marriages as well as heterosexual marriages. And I think it's an interesting question. There's plenty of evidence that demonstrates that actually marriages are good for society in all kinds of ways, the stability that they bring, the environment that they have for raising children. There are, of course, unhappy marriages, and there are destructive marriages and abusive marriages. We need to acknowledge that. But on the whole, they're good for society. It's an interesting question for Christians, I think, because we recognize marriage as being, it's not just another ethical issue. There is something very significant about marriage. We know that theologically because of what marriage depicts. We know it depicts the relationship between Christ and the church.
And it's pre-fall as
and
well,
we know
isn't
it's a pre-fall ordinance, to use a kind of the common phrase. So my question really for both of you actually is, to what extent should Christians be really out in the marketplace defending and pushing marriage? We've talked about ethical issues before, and actually how, without being defeatist, we need to recognise that there aren't going to be significant changes unless there is a movement of God in conversion. And we've gone back to look at, the example, things like slavery and how actually abolitionism came out of the revivals and that sort of thing. So should we feel the same about marriage? Should we just say, well, all we can do really is preach the gospel. As people are saved, they'll see the value of marriage. Or is there a case in and of itself to be made for marriage that Christians should be making?
I mean, that's an interesting question, because I heard about a secular marriage that was breaking down a couple of weeks ago, and I was heartbroken for the couple. So that there must be something going on there in my own heart, that it can't just be a Christian thing. Maybe that's because of what it points to, John?
Well, I think all of the evidence shows that marriage is the best possible context for bringing up of children. Yeah. And that's because of the kind of the commitment of the parents to each other. And anybody who's in a relationship, if it's solely founded on the basis of feelings towards one another, every relationship goes through times that are more difficult and times that are more stressful. The idea of a covenant commitment is it keeps people together because they've promised to be together in a sense no matter what. So the crucial thing about marriage is that sense of better or worse. And that's a foundation for stable settled relationships in a stable, settled society. And I think in that sense, the biblical pattern that God established and that God created is for the good of everyone and is to be sort of encouraged. Although I think we should also reflect that actually, even though in society, in a sense, people are not getting married as they once were, and there's almost been a sort of a liberal reaction against marriage, actually, if you look at it, the vast majority of people end up living their lives in a marriage-like way, that they enter into committed relationships, particularly when they have kind of children. So for all the talk in our society about overthrowing marriage in favor of other patterns of relationship, and you see that in our society at the moment with people advocating for polyamory, people advocating for same-sex relationships, in the end, the vast majority of people live their life in a way that looks remarkably like kind of what the Bible describes marriage as being.
Why are people so frightened of getting married then, do you think?
I think it's that they don't want to commit because there could be something better coming along, and it's more complicated to get out of it if I'm in a marriage.
Yeah, although it's interesting, what you're describing, I've seen amongst friends and neighbours, but actually as soon as you start jointly owning a home and all those sorts of things, it's just as complicated if you're married as if you're not.
Yeah,
in some ways, actually even more complicated, because if you die intestate and all those sorts of things, it becomes very complicated.
I think it's because of what culture's taught us about what relationships are, and they're romantic and they're feeling based. So actually, if I sign up to a marriage, I am dismissing the opportunity to have that with anybody else without severe complication. I think that's where a lot of it stems from.
And part of it is actually that the church took responsibility for controlling marriage within our culture, and it's part of the rejection of that place of the church in the life. If you go back to the New Testament times, marriage wasn't regulated by the state. You didn't have to go and get a state-authorized service in order to be married. Actually, marriage was a much more a community activity. It didn't necessarily require a ceremony. It required some kind of public commitment, some kind of public declaration, but it wasn't regulated by the state in quite that way. And whereas in our culture, as a result of the background of Christendom, originally it was the church that controlled kind of marriage, and then the state took that over. And as part of the kind of sort of changes after the Enlightenment, and particularly kind of in the 20th century, the rise of liberal progressivism, actually the overturning of marriage is partly because of that heritage of how it came to be a state-regulated and imposed form of relationship.
Is it another argument for not having a state church? Let's not go there. An interesting snippet in this. I think if you watch adverts on telly, if you're not smart enough to pre-record your programs and then scoot through them, if you watch the adverts for life insurance companies or whatever, you would always get the impression there are as many same-sex marriages as there are heterosexual marriages. You've always got to have your same-sex couple in the advert. The Sainsbury's has been running a series of press adverts recently, clothing, all same-sex couples. And I think that sort of message just slightly overwhelms us as believers. So it's quite interesting to see 2019, which is the latest year for which there's data, 213,000 heterosexual marriages, 6,700 same-sex marriages, so 3%. So actually, it's a smaller proportion than just the media message might give you a sense of.
Mm-hmm. I think another reason why there was a reaction against marriage, and this comes back to what you were saying, is that in the past, there was also a very restrictive approach to divorce, because of a particular Christian view of how divorce was available. So actually for a long period of time, divorce was hardly a possibility at all. In some instances, it required an act of parliament. And actually, I think there's a difference between encouraging people to marriage because of its positive benefits and thinking that the way to encourage people to marriages to have very, very restrictive divorce laws that make it very painful and difficult for marriages to be end. And sometimes that meant that people were in marriages that were abusive, that were inappropriate, where they were mistreated. And really, there was no way out of that relationship. So you ended up with a situation in which marriage became actually a form of kind of coercion that I think was not at all helpful and not biblical. The Bible recognizes the validity of marriage, but it also recognizes that in some circumstances, divorce is legitimate.
But no one goes into a marriage thinking, you know, if people go into marriages thinking it's going to last forever, don't they? They don't go in thinking, oh, I hope there's a way out.
They do. But if the reality of their experience is seeing people in marriages and unable to escape from them and where it's legitimately right for them to do so, they can imagine themselves in that situation.
Okay.
And I think therefore you have had a reaction against marriage in the 20th century that was partly because people were unable to escape marriages in circumstances when the Bible would say they really ought to be able to.
Yeah.
Well, we're running out of time.
Can we not talk about the dogs and the cats?
We're not going to talk about the dogs and the cats. We will just mention, though, you mentioned same-sex marriage. Some fascinating research done this week by a doctor who has transposed the R number. We're all familiar with the R number after COVID. He's transposed that to church attendance. Some very interesting results. We'll put the link in the bottom here. John, you were interviewed by The Times for that, I think, earlier in the week, weren't you? But fascinatingly, it generally trends that those who have adopted more progressive stances on marriage are all declining, and those who hold firm to the biblical view of marriage are all experiencing an R number that is replicating. That is fascinating. I think,
and the longer you've been on that liberal trajectory, the further down you sink. There's no once you're on that below the R number line, and it's interesting, the denominations who have only just been switching to accepting same-sex marriage are just below the R line, but those who have been much more liberal for longer are deeply, deeply in trouble.
And those are very revealing statistics in a week in which the Church of Scotland has chosen to perform same-sex relationships, and they are in spectacular decline. The statistics, some of the denominations that are apparently declining, it's a little bit more sort of mixed under the surface.
Of course,
because
it is.
For example, within the Anglican Church, there is a strong evangelical constituency, and the evangelical churches are growing. So it's not simply about the denominations, it's also about local churches. And the big picture is that churches that are preaching the gospel faithfully, that are declaring Christ as Lord, that are calling people to repentance and faith and to a committed life of following him, they are seeing growth. But that shouldn't surprise us at all, because the Bible tells us that it's the gospel that is the foundation for the church. It's the gospel that's the message of salvation.
Yep.
If that's not what the church is preaching, why would anybody want to keep coming to it?
Absolutely.
And in many of these declining churches, congregations are aged. They're going to die out in the next 20 years, not because they're not just new people coming, but their current congregations are sort of going to slowly die. And that's because they represent a previous period of folk Christianity where people had an attachment to the church. But for the younger generation, in a liberal progressive society, why would you want to go to church for that? Because all of the causes that you care about, you can actually pursue more effectively without having to add church into it as part of the package. So become an environmentalist campaigner, kind of join Extinction Rebellion, enter into politics.
You heard it here first.
You know, at one level, if the church is no longer offering uniquely what the church should offer, and I'm not saying the church shouldn't bring the gospel to bear on all of those areas of life, but actually if you're not any longer doing the key unique thing that the church by God is commissioned to do, you're not going to grow and survive.
And if you do that, your church will grow, according to these statistics.
So and you can join the FIC.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for listening to Independence, the FIEC podcast. Please do review and share if you've enjoyed what you've heard this afternoon. It's been me, Phil Topham, with John Stevens and Adrian Reynolds. We'll speak to you again soon. God bless.
Thanks, Phil.
See you.